things that I care to understand in deeper levels and be able to really, like we said at the top of our segment, really value who gets remembered and how, and why what can we do as journalists to really do a bit more to give these folks a nod for everything
Adriana,
that they do.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. We want to ask you to stay with us for a quick post-show to talk about your gorgeous piece, The Lucky Ones, about your own life, and also about the Alaska story for which you just won with a team of people the Pulitzer Prize. Adriana Gallardo, engagement reporter at ProPublica, part of a collaboration with the Anchorage Daily News that just won the prize. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio brings you a public service announcement from Prepare for Your Care.
I'm Erica Moseson, a lung and ICU doctor, offering you information on how to be prepared in case you or a loved one have to come to the hospital. Have a go bag ready with a list of your medications, the names and numbers of important contacts, especially your medical decision maker, in case you become so sick you can't speak for yourself, and also include copies of important medical documents, like an advance directive if you have one. You can find more information on what to include in your go bag, selecting a medical decision maker, and sharing your wishes at prepareforyourcare.org.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to News director, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, health officials in Oregon reported no new deaths today. 32 Oregon counties have applied to begin reopening this Friday, and Dr. Anthony Fauci testified before Congress this morning. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Tuesday afternoon, there have been 3,286 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. There have been 130 deaths. The Oregon Health Authority announced 61 new confirmed and 11 presumptive cases of coronavirus on Tuesday. For the fourth time this month, state health officials reported no new deaths. Approved Oregon counties will be allowed to begin the first phase of reopening from coronavirus restrictions on Friday, May 15th. Nationally, there are more than 1.3 million known cases of the novel coronavirus across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and four U.S. territories. At least 81,500 people with the virus have died. House Democrats have unveiled a sweeping $3 trillion economic relief measure, including $1 trillion for state, local, and tribal governments. The measure would also provide a $25 billion bailout for the U.S. Postal Service, which could run out of cash by September without aid from Congress. However, the measure is all but certainly dead on arrival in the Republican-led Senate. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened almost 4.2 million people across 177 countries. At least 288,300 people have died. All but four counties in Oregon have applied to the state to begin reopening this week. 32 of Oregon's 36 counties have applied to enter phase one of the state's reopening plan on Friday. The four counties that have not yet applied are Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Lincoln. Governor Kate Brown said this does not come as a surprise, since these counties are more densely populated and could be further away from being able to enter phase one of the plan. Phase one allows restaurants and bars to reopen, along with salons and gyms, as long as they can keep up with social distancing. The governor also provided guidelines for reopening childcare facilities on May 15th, with some limitations and specific guidelines. Once a county remains in phase one for at least 21 days, they can potentially move into phase two, which would allow for higher risk activities such as expanding gathering sizes. The specifics of phase two have not yet been finalized and will be guided by data collected during phase one. If a county shows an inability to meet contact tracing requirements and has an increase in the spread of COVID-19 and hospitalizations, the Oregon Health Authority will reevaluate their status. Oregon voters are being urged to get their ballot for May's primary in the mail by Thursday. All registered voters should have received their ballots already, and by using the prepaid envelope included, can mail the ballot by Thursday to ensure its tabulation for the Tuesday, May 19th primary election. Those who have not received their ballots are encouraged to contact their local elections office. Ballot return envelopes must be signed and received by the elections office by 8 p.m. on Tuesday. Postmarks do not count in Oregon. For those not mailing in their ballots, voters will need to drop theirs off at an official Dropbox site. For a complete listing of Oregon voter Dropbox locations, individuals can go online to sos.oregon.gov/voting. Races for Tuesday's primary include Secretary of State, Portland Mayor, Portland City Council, positions 1, 2, and 4, as well as Measure 2610, focusing on homelessness funding. Some women across the U.S. are already stretched thin as both breadwinners and primary caregivers. During the coronavirus pandemic, they are also now charged with teaching kids while the threat of unemployment persists. With more on the story, here's Eric Galatis.
Since the coronavirus sent the U.S. economy into a medically induced coma, more than 21 million jobs have been lost, and research shows women lost nearly 6 out of every 10 jobs across all sectors. In April alone, women's job losses were 5 times higher than the total loss during the Great Recession. Nicole Mason with the Institute for Women's Policy Research says women are more vulnerable during economic downturns because even though many are primary breadwinners or make substantial financial contributions, they make less money.
They earn lower wages compared to their male counterparts. And what that means is that in times such as this, they have less money in savings, and they also have less money to provide for their families.
Mason notes that during the Great Recession, men were the first to be hit, largely in production sectors such as manufacturing and construction. Because women are overrepresented in the service sector, Mason says in this downturn, women are experiencing disproportionately higher unemployment and job loss. Service sector jobs tend to pay lower wages and have fewer benefits, such as health care and paid sick leave, and workers struggle to afford child care and still meet their basic needs. During the pandemic, Mason says many women already stretched thin as both breadwinners and primary caregivers are now charged with teaching kids.
And for women who are in lower wage jobs or considered essential workers, this is really hard because many of them have to make the choice of going to work and making a living and taking care of their children.
Mason says since many workers will not get their jobs back right away as the economy recovers, stimulus checks and unemployment benefits should be extended until everyone can go back to work. She adds that lawmakers can close gaps exposed by the pandemic by raising the minimum wage, providing paid medical and family leave, child care subsidies, and other policies to support working families and women. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
In Oregon, jury trials are still occurring despite the coronavirus pandemic. Earlier this month, more than 120 potential jurors traveled to Multnomah County's courthouse for the first stage of a jury trial. Every person was spaced 6 feet apart and given masks. Despite these measures, many argue that in-person trials are a risk to public safety. Oregon is the first area in the country to resume in-person trials because its laws surrounding the right to speedy trials are less flexible than those of other states, and no emergency provisions are currently in place to delay a jury trial. Normally, trials must take place within 60 days of an arrest if the defendant is in custody. While Oregon judges are allowed to reschedule a trial date, if a trial does not start for 180 days, state law requires that the defendant be released. Oregon lawmakers have made it clear that there are no plans to change state trial laws. So even as the rest of the state maintains social distancing, in-person trials are scheduled to continue. Even longer wait times are to be expected from Oregonians needing services provided by the DMV when the offices are allowed to reopen. DMV field offices have been closed since March, and as the coronavirus crisis continues, it is unclear when they will be opening their doors to the public. Department officials estimate that a backlog of more than 100,000 people are waiting to get a new license, renewal, replacement, or endorsement. First-time drivers will just have to wait it out, as certified instructors are also unavailable to issue road exams, citing the difficulty in observing the 6-foot distancing rule while inside a car. This means that teens without an instruction permit have no legal means to obtain a valid license in Oregon, despite some states loosening requirements or waiving road tests in efforts to assist new drivers. Police are offering a grace period for expired vehicle licenses and tags as public health emergency continues. Coinciding with DMV closures, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued an extension on obtaining real ID until October 1, 2020, in hopes of offsetting an even greater backlog. With offices facing floods of people upon reopening, the DMV is urging people to go online, as some services can be done remotely or by mail. David House, a spokesperson for the Oregon DMV, said Monday, quote, "I would expect busy times at the DMV in the foreseeable future, into next year, and maybe even longer. This is an unprecedented time." Corvallis residents may be getting a knock on their doors this month, asking people if they'd agree to a coronavirus test. Door-to-door COVID-19 testing began on April 19th in Corvallis, seemingly the first of its kind in the country, in hopes that the results will aid scientists' abilities to track and estimate infection rates. It's called Trace COVID-19. It's conducted by Oregon State University and local healthcare workers and has received participation from roughly 80% of 237 residences that have been approached, with 455 individuals now being tested. Testing involves asking families to swab their noses and put the samples into containers on the doorsteps while researchers wait outside. Current data from the Trace COVID-19 project suggests that 2 people in 1,000 have the virus, an optimistic survey far below nationwide estimates. With the state marching towards a reopening plan, these statistics may provide key information on how social distancing has flattened the curve of infection and warns against lifting restrictions too quickly. Associate OSU Professor Ben Dalzier told KGW that while these initial findings proved to be very encouraging, he noted, quote, "If you go to a grocery store that has 100 people, chances are higher that at least one is infected. You're sort of rolling that dice 100 times," end quote. Efforts to continue the study will maintain for several weeks with the hopes of expanding door-to-door testing to other communities like Portland. A restaurant in Colorado defied closure orders and allowed dine-in service last Sunday. For more, here's KBOO's Al Khan.
A restaurant in Castle Rock, Colorado that defied the governor's orders has been shut down by local health authorities. The CNC Coffee and Kitchen went against Governor Jared Polis's orders for the closure of all bars and restaurants by opening its doors on Mother's Day. Colorado Community Media reporter Nick Puckett recorded footage last Sunday morning of nearly every table in the eatery full and customers waiting in line out the door. There was no social distancing being practiced, and almost no one was wearing a mask. Many people in the crowded restaurant praised the defiance of the governor's orders, which restricts food service businesses to takeout only, while ignoring any protocol put in place to protect from the virus. The restaurant's owner, April Ariano, told the Castle Rock News Press, quote, "I'm so happy so many people came out to support the Constitution and stand up for what is right. We did our time. We did our 2 weeks. We did more than 2 weeks. We had to do something," end quote. Local health authorities arrived at the restaurant midday Monday and ordered it to close immediately. In a statement, the health department's executive director, Dr. John M. Douglas Jr., said that if the establishment chooses not to obey state restrictions, it could lose its license. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two in-depth interviews. First, with Multnomah County District Attorney candidate Ethan Knight, followed by an interview with Sonia Montalbano, judge candidate for the Multnomah County Circuit Court. At 6, we'll be hearing preference, and at 7, it's calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy early, followed by showers in the afternoon and a high of 63. Today in history, in 1820, British social reformer and founder of modern nursing, Florence Nightingale, is born. Her birthday is now observed around the world as International Nurses Day to mark the contributions that nurses make to society. The quote of the day is from Florence Nightingale, who said, quote, "How very little can be done under the spirit of fear." Today, there are special elections in the 25th District of California and the 7th District of Wisconsin, plus primaries in Nebraska. With more on those stories, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
For the April election, the day before the election, they were trying to call it off. And so the municipal clerks, you know, were hearing one thing and then another. And all that stress is out of the picture for this time.
Deanne Cook is the Barron County Clerk in Wisconsin's 7th District. There's a special election there today, and it's in much better shape than statewide elections last month.
We do have some National Guard folks that are stepping in to help because of a few people are short poll workers.
In some of the bigger cities, people who either stood in line or worked at the polls later tested positive for COVID-19. And even then, with the National Guard's help, poll worker shortages led to hours-long lines. But the 7th District is more rural. It has no big cities. It went for Barack Obama in 2008, but then for Mitt Romney in 2012, and President Donald Trump in 2016. Kyle Condick, an analyst from University of Virginia's Center for Politics, expects the Republican trend to continue.
That was the district that used to be a lot more Democratic than it is now. Trump won it by about 20 points. You know, I don't think the Republican will win by 20 points, but I think I'd be shocked if the Republicans lost it. That's just territory that has become much more Republican.
It's more of a toss-up in California's 25th, another district with a special election today. Though Republicans haven't picked up a House seat in California in 20 years, the 25th is an exurban area north of Los Angeles. It's much more competitive than the state as a whole.
Democrats are kind of sounding pessimistic notes about it. Republicans are optimistic, but you know, sometimes that stuff is just kind of expectation setting.
While Democratic Assemblywoman Christy Smith was the favorite coming in, Condick says that Republican veteran and defense contractor Mike Garcia gained ground in recent weeks. Still, Condick says,
I don't think we should be shocked if either side wins. Big picture trends in this district, I think, are positive for Democrats. Sometimes that's more important than the day-to-day news cycle.
Nebraska voters also go to the polls today, but for statewide primaries rather than a special election. Though incumbent Republicans will have the edge in most races come November, University of Nebraska political science professor Jeff Lorenz says the field of Democratic congressional candidates has been unique.
These candidates are not just like coming out of Omaha, or Lincoln for that matter. They're coming from a lot of different parts of the state and often have backgrounds that involve a lot of different and interesting and frankly kind of like unusual ways to get into politics. But in a lot of cases, that can be useful, right? Having a different sort of perspective from what we might imagine the typical candidate being.
Yesterday, almost 2,000 former Department of Justice officials signed an open letter, again calling for Attorney General William Barr's resignation. This time, it's in response to his dropping of criminal charges against Michael Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor. Flynn pleaded guilty to lying about his communications with Russia and later withdrew his plea after cooperating with law enforcement. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Dr. Anthony Fauci testified before Congress this morning. KABU's Al Khan has the story.
This morning, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the White House top expert on infectious disease, testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Fauci warned Congress that states reopening for business too soon are running a grave risk that may result in an escalation of COVID-19 outbreaks that may not be able to be controlled. In his testimony, Dr. Fauci outlined the possible consequences of reopening too soon, including that without widespread testing and contact tracing, new hotspots could emerge, which not only would lead to unnecessary suffering and deaths, but would also set back the potential timeline for a national economic restart. Dr. Fauci also stated that although there are more than 100 vaccines being developed at this time, there is no guarantee that any will be effective, and in a worst-case scenario, a vaccine could backfire and actually strengthen the virus. This testimony comes at a time when COVID-19 continues to spread across the nation, with more than 1.3 million confirmed cases and close to 81,000 people having succumbed to the disease, according to Johns Hopkins University. For KABU News, I'm Al Khan.
An emergency homeless shelter has been set up in Rapid City, South Dakota, and Wisconsin is providing free COVID-19 tests to tribes. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An emergency homeless shelter in Rapid City, South Dakota is up and running. It's designed to handle a potential COVID-19 outbreak among the homeless population and offer care during the pandemic. Lee Strubinger reports.
And we'll see the shower facilities in this.
The Civic Center's Rushmore Hall is transformed into a three-tiered emergency shelter. Jeremy Walla with the Pennington County Emergency Operations Center gives a tour. The facility is complete with beds and laundry service. The emergency center, supported by several city, county, and tribal organizations, has showers and hot water heaters. 9 medical staff will work on a rotating basis and offer 24-hour support. Geraldine Church is the CEO of the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Health Board. Church says tribal epidemiologists are tracking data from tribes in South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa.
Some of the data might lead people to believe that our numbers are going down in South Dakota, but those numbers were an anomaly because of the Smithfield outbreak in Sioux Falls. You take out that anomaly, and what we see, according to our epidemiology center, is that the numbers are going up here in Pennington County, as well as our nearby reservation communities.
While COVID-19 cases are still low in the western part of the state, Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender says they are preparing for a worst-case scenario.
If we get the best outcome possible, all this will be for nothing, and we'll look like we overreacted. So the goal here is to look like we overreacted and spent money that didn't need to be spent. It's a pretty odd situation for government and for a community to go through.
The John T. Vukurevich Foundation provided $23,000 to put up the emergency center. Allender says local governments will foot the bill for ongoing costs. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Oglala Sioux Tribe issued an emergency 72-hour shutdown of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota Monday night after 2 positive cases of COVID-19 were confirmed on the reservation. All business is to cease on the reservation during the lockdown order. Only workers considered critical are exempt, which includes medical and emergency personnel. The emergency order was announced Monday night by the tribe's COVID-19 task force on the radio and on social media. All tribal members in Wisconsin will have access to free COVID-19 testing under a new plan put in place by the governor. It's a response to higher infection and death rates in minority communities. Ben Meyer has more.
Wisconsin has 11 federally recognized tribes, with most reservations in the rural northern part of the state. Despite the relative isolation of many, Governor Tony Evers said the state is working hard to give access to testing to all tribal members.
I meet regularly with leaders of every week, actually, leaders of the tribal nations of Wisconsin. But at the end of the day, We will continue to serve all the tribal members, all the tribes in the state of Wisconsin.
The Wisconsin National Guard has assisted with COVID-19 testing, serving the Bad River and St. Croix bands of Ojibwe. Wisconsin Department of Health Services Secretary Designee Andrea Palm said the state is also giving tribes other options for providing testing.
They have the option to order testing supplies through the website and write those kits. Those supplies can be sent directly to the tribe to be used in their own tribal health clinics and then returned.
Many Wisconsin tribal communities, like the Lac des Flambeaux, have closed or severely restricted access to tribal lands and facilities. The Universal Free Testing Program also extends to African Americans and Latinos in Wisconsin. For National Native News, I'm Ben Meyer in northern Wisconsin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As COVID-19 continues to sweep across the world, Canada stands out. As historic examples reinforce, major global disruptions like pandemics can create opportunities for positive change. Nadia Ramlagan has the story.
They may be 5,000 miles apart, but North Carolina has a few things in common with Canada's Northwest Territories. And one doctor there says the response to the coronavirus pandemic is a perfect opportunity to address another health threat. Courtney Howard is an emergency room doctor in Yellowknife, Canada, in one of the fastest warming regions on the planet. She thinks the collective energy generated by the world's response to the COVID-19 crisis can also be harnessed to fight climate change.
We've already shown that we can reduce deaths tremendously by acting together, and I think that we're going to be able to take that sense of accomplishment and move it toward climate change.
She believes that as countries dole out economic stimulus money, they have a chance to allocate public funds with human, ecological, and social health in mind. Howard says in the long term, this will not only increase resilience to future disasters, but make them less likely. She points to actions like cleaning up abandoned oil and gas wells and reducing air pollution as ways to improve both human and environmental health. Howard says prioritizing mental health is another key to tackling both of these tough issues. She says for years, she's seen patients struggling with loss of income, food, and housing from climate-related events, not unlike the effects of the devastating floods in North Carolina. It's what she calls ecological grief.
And now what we're seeing is pandemic-related stress. On a clinical level, in my shifts, I'd say at least 70% of the presentations right now have an element of anxiety.
The average surface temperature in the Northwest Territories has risen about 2 degrees Celsius since the 1940s, leading to thawing permafrost, rising sea levels, and more extreme weather events. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 12, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Emily Crook, Al Kahn, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and the engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Nadia Ramlagan, and Eric Galatis. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Co-host Jacqueline Keeler discusses the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe's power struggle for sovereign protection of their own people. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, taking on art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Dirt Bag. Host Glenn Anderson talks all things gardening and introduces a new plant of the month. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We continue our coverage of the race for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12 today by talking to candidate Sonia Montalbano. She has been a lawyer in Multnomah County for over 20 years, making a point to deal in many different types of case law. Originally from New York, Montalbano was a first-generation college student, eventually obtaining her law degree from Lewis and Clark Law School. Her legal accomplishments include being a delegate of the Oregon State Bar, among others, and she has helped to raise money for nonprofit organizations, including the Campaign for Equal Justice, the Public Interest Law Project, and Oregon Literacy. So, to start out, what inspired you to run for this position?
Well, I have been wanting to be a judge for about 10 years. It's something that I always thought about in terms of how I could best serve my community using my legal background. And in this particular instance, the judge that is retiring reached out to me to let me know that he was retiring. And he let me know that the timing of it was going to open it up to an election. And he encouraged me to run. My background has been in politics in a lot of different ways over the years, but I've worked on a number of different campaigns, including the last open judicial election 12 years ago. And so I did some due diligence and I thought about it and decided, you know, it'll either happen through an appointment or an election. I have the opportunity. I really am going to go for it. So that's why I decided to run.
We don't often get a chance to have a competitive race for circuit court judge in Multnomah County. So to your mind, what should voters be focusing on?
I think voters, when it comes to who would make a good judge, need to look to the peers of that individual. And so, for example, I have a lot of endorsements from sitting Multnomah County Circuit Court judges. I have endorsements from Clackamas Court judges. I have an endorsement from someone on the Court of Appeals. I also have a lot of endorsements from attorneys who work in a variety of areas. I've done a wide variety of types of cases over the years, in part because I knew I wanted to serve as a judge someday, and so I wanted to make sure I wasn't having to get up to speed on everything. So I've done criminal, I've done civil, I've done personal injury, I've represented plaintiffs, I've represented defendants, I've represented small businesses or local businesses and bigger businesses. And attorneys who have been on the same side of cases as me and on the other side of cases of me from me have all endorsed me. And so I think that speaks to the confidence that people who are in the legal community will have in my ability to serve as a judge. I'm also extremely proud that a number of my clients have endorsed me. It's actually nothing I sought out, but a number of them saw my name and reached out to me and said, I would love to say something in support of your candidacy because of the way that you, you know, handled my case or my representation. So I think that's who people should be looking at when they're deciding whether or not someone should be a judge. I think you also want to look to what have they done in the community. Are they well connected? Will they be able to connect to people from different walks of life? One of the things that I think you make me a little differently qualified than some of my fellow candidates is I grew up in New York. It is the melting pot of the United States. I engaged on a daily basis with people from every walk of life, every socioeconomic strata, every different culture, every different religion, different languages. And it's just a cultural competency is kind of a day-to-day thing that you have to have if you're going to make your way through the world in New York. And I think that gives me the ability when I'm on the bench, if there's someone who doesn't look like me, doesn't sound like me, I'm going to find a way to connect with them based on my own previous life experience.
Gotcha. So your platform lists confidence in the legal system as a priority. How would you use the position to further that goal?
One of the things that I would hope happens after we come through this situation is a lot of people don't have confidence in the judiciary or the legal system because many, many, many people who are finding themselves in the court system are unrepresented. And we need to increase our funding for legal aid. And that's definitely something that I will work on as a judge. It's something I've worked on for 10 years. I'm on the advisory committee for the Campaign for Equal Justice, and that's an organization of lawyers that works to raise money for legal aid. But the other arm of that, which is something I'd like to see expanded upon, is it also works to educate the public on the statistics of how many people go into court and they are unrepresented. They can't find a lawyer that they can afford. There aren't enough lawyers to assist them. And they come out of those situations feeling like they weren't treated fairly and that it's rigged. And that's one of the things that I would like to focus on when I'm elected. If you can get people the representation that they need, they will come out of that feeling like they at least had a little bit more of a level playing field. That's what the courts are supposed to be. It's unfortunate that it's not right now.
Can you be a little bit more specific about that? So people aren't, even though they are legally entitled to an attorney, they're not able to find one and by default have to represent themselves. Is that right?
Yes. So we are talking about if you don't have enough money and you're involved in a criminal matter, you will hopefully qualify for a public defender. There are people that fall in between the sort of criteria for that where they don't have enough or they make too much money, sorry, to qualify for a public defender, but they don't really have enough to pay for an attorney to assist them. So those people are often unrepresented. Also, the public defenders, and again, this is just focusing on the criminal side, are incredibly overworked in the state of Oregon. And so I think a lot of people who encounter public defenders feel that their cases maybe don't get the attention that they should, or they don't get the attention that they should. You know, lawyers have anywhere from, I'll just pick numbers, you know, 20 to 100 cases on their plate at any given time. Well, that individual has one case and they want to feel that they are being represented by someone that has the time to pay attention to it. On the civil side, we have thousands of people finding themselves in the legal system who simply, there are no public defenders for people who are on the civil side. There's legal aid, and legal aid is very limited in what they can do in terms of providing services, both in terms of scope and in terms of the number of people that they can represent. We simply do not have enough legal aid lawyers to represent the people that need them. And so I think if we have increased funding in both those areas, that will go a long way towards instilling more confidence in our judicial system.
So, you know, obviously your experience, as with others in the race, is as an attorney. Do you anticipate challenges in making the transition to being a judge?
I think anyone who is fortunate enough to serve in the position as a judge is going to experience challenges when they make that transition. And in part, it's because for your career as a lawyer, you're an advocate. And as a judge, you cannot advocate for one side or the other. But I also think that there will be maybe fewer challenges for me than some others because of the breadth of the scope of my practice.
you know, I've handled such a wide variety of cases that I will be very familiar with the issues that come before me, whether it be an employment case, whether it be an elder abuse case, whether it be a restraining order case, whether it be an assault case. I'm familiar with those issues. And so I think every judge has a learning curve. I think mine will be a little less steep than my fellow candidates. But I do think, yeah, you do have to transition from being an advocate to a neutral. Fortunately, for the last, I think it's 12 years, I've been serving as an arbitrator on the Multnomah County Mandatory Arbitration Program panel. And I've been an arbitrator for, I'm going to guess, somewhere in the range of 50 cases over the years. And in that case, you have to be neutral. You have to listen to both sides. You have to weigh the evidence. You have to evaluate the credibility of the people that are appearing before you. And I've done that. And then you have to make the decision. I think the important thing is when you make the decision that the people who are on the receiving end of that feel like it was fair. And so whenever I've issued decisions, I've almost always issued a letter opinion to the parties, many of whom are unrepresented, because I want them to understand what happened, what was considered, and why the decision was made. So I feel in that sense, I've already been doing that, so I'll be able to do that as a judge as well.
What kind of cases end up in arbitration?
So in cases will end up in arbitration in one of two ways. One, there's a contract or some provision that requires the matter to be arbitrated. But in Oregon, Multnomah County, if you have a case that is under $50,000 in damages and there are no equitable decisions to be made, then it will go automatically to arbitration. And an equitable decision is one that's really based on what's fair. Different principles of law apply than those that focus on determining money damages and whether or not someone is even entitled to them. So those cases end up in arbitration. If a party is dissatisfied with that outcome, they can appeal and they can go before a court or a jury. We have a constitutional right to go and have a jury hear our cases. But there are some components built into the system that would maybe deter the parties from appealing a decision that they were not satisfied with. But that's how they get to arbitration. It's just a number or a contractual term.
So you also have expressed that your platform, you're interested in restorative justice. Can you tell me about how you would work towards that as a judge?
Sure. Restorative justice has a number of different ways in which people look at it. One of the most important things is there are a lot of times people end up in the criminal justice system who really don't belong there. There are people with mental health care issues. There are people with houselessness issues or addiction issues. And a restorative justice approach, everyone has to be on board with it. You get the person who's allegedly committed the crime, you get the person who's the alleged victim of the crime, you get the defender, public defender or the defense lawyer, the prosecutor, the DA, you get the judge involved. And together, you try and come up with an outcome that feels both fair to the person who has been wronged or to, oftentimes it's a crime against society, so the district attorney will bring it on behalf of the city or the county. And the defendant also feels that they aren't necessarily just going to be spending a sentence in a room locked up, because I think one of the things we've seen over time is that just putting people in jail does not do anything to help the people who are imprisoned to make better decisions in the future when they're released. It's not rehabilitation. It's just punitive in nature. There have been a number of organizations throughout the country, including in Oregon, where we've seen that if you can work with incarcerated individuals while they're in prison, then help them when they transition out and provide them with support, resources, education, job resources, they will be very unlikely to offend again. And that's the type of approach I would like to see taken on cases where it's appropriate. You know, where it's not appropriate, not everyone's going to be on board with that. But I feel that one of the most powerful things you can see sometimes in some criminal cases where people have been, harmed significantly is a moment where oftentimes after a sentence has been issued and someone's been found guilty, and is the victim of the crime or the victim's family will get up and they will forgive or offer words of forgiveness toward the person who committed the crime. And that has such a powerful impact on the person who's being sentenced. And if we can do that at the outset, I think we may be able to eliminate some of the disproportionate impact we've seen on how these punitive measures have on different populations, and go a long way towards reducing our prison population.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up today?
I would be honored to serve in my capacity as a judge, and if I'm elected, I will do everything I can to serve the people of Multnomah County. And so the people who appear before me will feel that they are heard, respected, and that they were treated fairly when they come out of the courtroom, regardless of the outcome. So I appreciate your vote on May 19th.
Sweet. Sonia, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
We've been speaking with Sonia Montalbano, a candidate for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Position 12. More information on Sonia and her campaign is available online at sonia4judge.com. Ballots need to be mailed by the 14th or dropped off on May 19th. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
We are virtually sitting down with Ethan Knight, a current candidate for Multnomah County District Attorney. Ethan Knight has served as an Assistant United States Attorney for over a decade and previously served as Deputy District Attorney in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. He currently serves as President of the Oregon Law Foundation, an organization dedicated to ensuring access to justice for those without the means to hire an attorney. He has been recognized with some of the Justice Department's highest awards for his work handling security cases during the Obama administration, including by former Attorney General Loretta Lynch. He is endorsed by the Portland Police Association, Multnomah County Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and Portland Public Safety Action Coalition. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Knight. First, what inspired you to run for district attorney?
You know, I grew up in this community, and I care deeply about this community, and I've spent over 20 years as a public servant and really as an advocate as a state and federal prosecutor. So for me, it was not a big leap then to take the opportunity to run for district attorney, to convey and leverage the work I've done over the past 20 years into a position that really is as the primary and chief law enforcement officer for this community.
How would your past experiences, such as your position as Assistant United States Attorney, contribute to being a successful DA?
As far as my work as a federal prosecutor over the past really 13 years, there's a direct correlation, obviously, between that kind of work and being a state prosecutor, having done that. But most importantly, I think what it's given me, particularly handling some very significant and high-profile cases in an environment where there's a lot of pressure but really high expectations and an attention to detail, is, you know, an ability and willingness to carry that vision and that work experience to an environment where there's a lot of public scrutiny as well. And so I'd be able to, you know, really leverage the quality and depth of that kind of prosecution experience in a way that I think the community can expect both transparency, but then also a thorough, careful, and ethical approach to my work that I've exhibited as a federal prosecutor.
Your website states that the biggest challenge facing our community is homelessness, and that it is critical to recognize that homelessness is not a crime. As DA, what could you do to work towards decriminalizing homelessness?
Well, I mean, I think for starters, really, it's worth mentioning that increasingly our biggest challenge will be, you know, in relation to specific things like homelessness, will be the coronavirus and how that impacts public health and how it impacts our state and local budgets. Now, having said that, going back to sort of my view of homelessness being, I think, our biggest challenge and biggest issue, and your question about what can I do to ensure that it's not criminalized, I think the answer to that is focusing on, you know, the overlap of the problem with the criminal justice system. In other words, not casting a wide net and saying that homelessness per se is criminal, but really focusing on homeless individuals who may be victims of crime, focusing on those amongst the homeless population who are victimizing others and maybe responsible for a larger percentage of those crimes, but not talking about the condition of being without a home is criminal, more focusing on the conduct itself. And I think that'll get us to a better place to keep everyone safer, including those who are on the streets and really are our most vulnerable citizens.
And you mentioned COVID-19 a little bit when talking about homelessness. What are some other obligations of the DA you think are going to have to adapt to changes due to this COVID-19 crisis?
Well, I mean, I think in the short term, and I say short term because this is an issue really that will be dealt with, I think, primarily by the current district attorney, Rod Underhill, in the current system. It'll be how do you manage the jails and the courthouse with, you know, an emergent sort of public health issue. In other words, how do you ensure that people are kept safe in those close quarters? And that can be, you know, anything from witnesses and litigants in the courthouse to obviously folks in the jail system. I think longer term, the issue really becomes one of budget. And that is, you know, I think how does the district attorney really become an advocate in the system for the needs of the community and the criminal justice system and all sides of it? Because I think the reality is we're going to be facing tremendous pressure. I mean, the chair just released a preliminary budget with some cuts and then said there are more coming. And I think anyone in state and local government knows that's the case. So, you know, the reality is that's what we're facing. Now, I think there's a secondary issue. I say secondary because it's sort of one that maybe people aren't thinking about as much, but I think the economic toll on everyone, including our most vulnerable citizens, means we're going to have to be very mindful of how they relate and interact with the criminal justice system. And that means victims, defendants, folks with really very little. How do we ensure that they're continuing to be treated fairly by the system?
Branching off of that a little bit, the fair treatment of the system, in situations involving threats and acts of violence in the community, you've stated that people who may mistrust the law enforcement and take matters into their own hands are often making unsafe decisions. As DA, how would you begin to restore confidence in the justice system?
Well, I think it's a couple ways. I mean, I think, you know, transparency is a key piece of that. We talk about that a lot, but what that means is that you have a district attorney's office and law enforcement where, to the extent possible, decisions are made in a transparent way and people understand why things are done and what the numbers show and why certain steps are being taken. You know, but I think the other piece of that is you need to abide to the rule of law, and that means, you know, following the law regardless of political pressure in a way that people can trust that their system is being managed with credibility and fairly. I mean, you know, one of the first things I noticed when I started as a young district attorney, you know, now over two decades ago, was how many of the victims in the system were really from poor and underserved communities. And really the most vulnerable citizens. And these were folks who then were thrust into the system. And I think when you talk about trust, you need to ensure that people know that regardless of your background, that the system treats you fairly. And so I think that an even-handed approach and a transparent approach are the best ways to do that.
As DA, what are some other ways you might plan on creating a more fair system in terms of economic status?
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, one area or one sort of focus I've had throughout my career, even beyond the prosecution work I've done, is really related to access to justice, and that is in the legal system, ensuring that even beyond the criminal prosecution, but in our courts, people with limited resources get access to legal aid, can have access to the court system, and those needs are becoming more acute. And I think as a district attorney, that'll be an area where I'm a public voice in talking about the need to have our courts opened up and to have access to justice for all. Now, what does that mean? mean specifically as it relates to the system, you know, I've talked and written about the need to be very mindful of how fines and fees imposed on criminal defendants who then complete their sentences successfully can really follow someone for a long time and get in the way of getting housing or successfully reentering the community. So that's one piece. I would advocate strongly to ensure that those sorts of things can be expanded so we don't unfairly penalize people for not having money, essentially. And the other thing is to work more concertedly to support reentry into the community for both the defendants and victims, too, who are coming through the system. And what that means is when somebody leaves the system or successfully completes the sentence, how can we best ensure that they don't come back or they have access to services? And that can be, you know, pushing more expungements for criminal convictions. That can mean being more mindful of when somebody leaves the system, giving them access points to social services, which is something we don't really think about oftentimes as prosecutors, but it's equally important.
Mental health issues can be intertwined with homelessness, drug use, and monetary fears, and affect a lot of people that go through the system. As DA, how could you work on making sure people with mental health issues don't get lost in the prison system?
Well, I mean, you know, as district attorney, what you need to do, I mean, you can't control what happens once someone gets sentenced. So you really need to focus more on ensuring there are options at the front end when somebody comes in and is charged. And, you know, the tricky thing about mental health, even distinct from addiction, and there's overlap between the two, is how nuanced and complicated it can be in finding the right avenues for support and treatment. And so there are a couple ways to address that. I mean, I think, you know, mental health courts, where we have, you know, courts specifically designed to address folks who have mental illness who are in the criminal justice system. That's one way. And then the other piece really is a funding piece. I mean, it's being an advocate and ensuring that people appreciate, you know, you can say you support mental health resources, but you need the kind of probation officers and support in the criminal justice system once folks are there for mental illness. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And if somebody's sentenced to a crime who also has a concurrent mental illness, you can't simply just expect them to go through and then put them back out in the community without adequate support and treatment services. And that's, you know, something that's been chipped away at for decades, of course, is our public health and public mental health resource availability. But ensuring that it's there in the criminal justice system, I think, is critical. And recognizing that it should be part of the criminal justice system so we can give folks support to come through.
What is one issue in this campaign that you don't think gets enough attention?
You know, I think that we have lost sight of the fact about how vulnerable many of our victims are in the same way that many of our criminal defendants are, and the role that poverty plays in those two, with those two groups. You know, as I alluded to earlier, I talked about how as a young DA, I saw victims come through the system who had so little, who were poor and from underserved communities. And I think that people often forget that people who live in neighborhoods or unstable living situations or on the streets are more likely to be victimized. And, you know, part of being a prosecutor is protecting the most vulnerable, particularly in our state system. And our most vulnerable are often the ones who don't have the resources or the support in their lives otherwise, and they're victimized by other people. And I think we forget that. And so I think that's something that's sort of got lost in the discussion. But to me, it resonated very strongly throughout my career.
Do you have any more last closing thoughts for our listeners?
Only that, you know, we are obviously at a challenging time at so many levels in our community. And, you know, I think I bring to the table is a professionalism. And support from a wide variety of folks and an understanding of the criminal justice system, and that, you know, if I'm district attorney, that credibility and professionalism will really guarantee that things are run well and that people can rest assured that, you know, the rule of law is well served and honestly served and reflects the values of the community.
And lastly, where can listeners find more information about your campaign?
Great question. My website contains, you know, a considerable amount of material, both supporter statements, substantive written policy information, and other information as well. And that's www.electethanknight, that's one word, .com.
Okay. And with that, thank you very much for joining me today to answer some questions.
Absolutely, and thank you so much.
We have been speaking with Ethan Knight, who is currently a candidate for Multnomah County District Attorney. Ballots for the election of Multnomah County DA are due on May 19th. More information about Knight's campaign can be found at electethanknight.com. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Melissa Hood.
KBOO Portland.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new